All right, good morning, everyone. It's so wonderful to be here. And if you had seen me 5, 10 years ago, you would know that I haven't been running for a few years. But at one stage, I was doing that quite diligently. I was running about a 5K around my neighborhood 2 or 3 times a week, and I managed to do that for a few years. And over the years, I got to know the neighborhood dogs, because they would hear me coming, especially if I was running with my dog, and they would greet me with lots of loud barking. And imagine, though, as I was running around the neighborhood, instead of being greeted by these dogs barking at me, imagine as I saw my neighbors, they, in essence, came and greeted me, barking at me. "This is not your place. Go away, go away, go away." I would be offended, and I would probably be a little bit afraid of my neighbors. So why is it that I've come to be quite happy with dogs barking at me, one set of behaviors, and yet when it comes to humans, I'm expecting a different set of behaviors? I mean, even for those who are going to pretend to ignore me, I'm expecting at least a bit of a civil South African, "How's it?" All right? Why do I have these different sets of expectations for one kind of creature, aka the neighborhood dogs, and another kind of creature, humanity? And where do these different sets of expectations come from? Now, I'm speaking here as a Christian, and I have a particular worldview. So is it because I'm a Christian? I've got a particular view of humanity, and so as a Christian, I expect dogs to behave in one way and humans to behave in another way. What if I was a Muslim runner? What if I was a Hindu runner? What if I was an atheistic runner? Would I have different expectations? And I would argue, no, I would not have different expectations. I would still expect dogs to bark at me and humans to act, well, humanely towards me. And so if we all have these expectations, where do these expectations come from? I want to make the argument today that we all believe in human dignity. And even those who deny it from the stage or the classroom or on YouTube, they accept it the minute they step out into the real world. And if I'm right, do we have a worldview that explains this, that gives rise to this innate sense of human value that we all seem to live according to? So let me tell you what you get with me, and you've already heard a brief introduction about me, but my name is Stephen Pullman. I'm a pastor, and I do have a degree in theology, and I do have a degree, oddly enough, in geology, but I don't have a degree in psychology or philosophy. I don't have a master's. I don't have a PhD, typically the kind of things that qualify you to stand on stages such as this. So my working assumption today is that most people in this room are smarter than me. So if that is true, what am I doing here? Well, I'm a pastor, and I care very deeply about the intersection of faith and life and the questions that can become obstacles, either for Christians or for those looking into Christianity, for faith in Christ. And I care very deeply about doing that intersection well and helping others do that. But here's what I have experienced in my life thus far is while apologetics and the world of faith and reason, what this conference is all about, have become very meaningful to me and were very much a part of my growth and maturity in Christianity, people would come to me with their questions or their objections or their uncertainties, and I would give them, for example, a William Lane Craig book on apologetics. And on average, my discovery was they would read page one and close it. In other words, I started to very quickly realize that 90% of my congregation, who weren't students in philosophy or theology or the sciences, weren't being equipped to navigate the world of faith and reason. Equally, I'd have conversations with my neighbors who possibly weren't Christians, and I'd find very much the same thing, that the kind of level at which most of our apologetics is pitched, most people out there, the guy at the hardware store, your neighbor, aren't thinking at those levels. And so once again, I started to realize there is a huge gap between the great literature that is out there and where the average person is. And so I decided to try and bridge that gap with my book, The Reason for Everything. Now, if you are a student of philosophy or psychology or the sciences, maybe my book is not so much aimed at you, although I hope that you do find value in it. But the book is aimed at your sibling, your neighbor, the waitron that you meet on the weekend, your kids in varsity, maybe even high school. Trying to bridge this gap and enable people to accessibly think about the most important questions of life. And one of the things, as I've kind of dabbled in the world of faith and reason and apologetics, is I think that one of the greatest areas that we as Christians can speak into is the area of human dignity. And it is one of the chapters of my book. And the obvious place to start is the abundant evidence that we all live as if there is value inherently in humanity. For example, why is it that when you go to the Kruger Park and you're lucky enough, which I haven't been thus far, you're lucky enough to witness a lion killing an impala? Why is it that the first thing you do is slam on the brakes and pull out your cameras? But if you had to be unlucky enough to witness a lion killing another human being, the first thing you'll do is stop your car and throw up. And why is it that when we see humans treating other humans like animals or with violence, which is the law of the natural world, we are horrified? Doesn't matter what your worldview is. We inherently respond as if there is something wrong and inhumane about that. So part of the question is, well, what does it mean to be human? Especially if we try to think about it from a non-theistic perspective. What does it mean to be set apart from the rest of the created order? And some have said it's our intelligence, that we have a superior intellect, and that is what sets us apart. That is what defines us as human beings. And so my pushback would be, well, what about those who, for whatever reason, are cognitively impaired? Are they less human? Is there less dignity to be ascribed towards them? And the answer is no, of course. They are still worthy of all human dignity. Well, others have said maybe it's the fact that we're economic beings. And I often think that if an alien had to observe humanity, possibly Pretoria East, for a couple of hours, they would see that we are economic beings. We spend our entire days at work earning money so that we can spend it either on our utility bills or our mortgages, or on Amazon, or on Kindle, or on Facebook Marketplace. We trade and barter. But what about those who have no economic power? Are they less human? And we'd say very quickly, of course not. Others have said, well, maybe it's our self-determination. The fact that I can choose. As the poem Invictus says, I am the master of my own fate. I am the captain of my soul. That is what sets us apart. I mean, I don't see my black Labrador with an org chart and a life plan. So maybe that's what makes us human. Except, what about those humans who do not have autonomy, who are in slavery or are incapable of making their own decisions? Are they less human? And the answer is, of course not. They are still worthy of dignity. So what is it that makes us human? In fact, if we look at the secular narrative at the moment, if we are simply here as a result of unguided evolutionary forces, then there is nothing that sets us apart from the rest of the created order. Now, it's not just Christian apologists like me who say these things to get a kind of a one-up on those who believe differently to me. Jerry Coyne, who is a prominent evolutionary biologist from Chicago, he claims and recognizes that we have no value and meaning. He says we have no more extrinsic purpose than a squirrel or an armadillo. And he is absolutely right. Now, this is not just an idea for the philosophy classroom. These ideas have consequences. And one of those consequences, I know, is an extreme case, but that is Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler looked at the natural world and he said, nature is cruel, therefore we too can be cruel. In Mein Kampf, he said, if nature does not wish that weaker individuals should mate with the stronger, she wishes even less that a superior race should intermingle with an inferior one. Because in such cases, all her efforts throughout hundreds of thousands of years to establish an evolutionary higher state of being may thus be rendered futile. Listen to this. He who does not wish to fight in this world, where permanent struggle is the law of life, has no right to exist. He is simply being consistent with the atheistic evolutionary laws of nature. Charles Darwin himself said, "Nature is red in tooth and claw. Violence and indignity are the rules of nature." Now, is Hitler a cheap shot? Was he just a bad apple? He modeled his ideologies on atheistic naturalism. And what he did was very consistent with that. Viktor Frankl, a psychiatrist and Holocaust survivor, he made this observation: "I am absolutely convinced that the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Majdanek were ultimately prepared not in some ministry or other in Berlin, but rather at the desks, lecture halls of nihilistic scientists and philosophers." In other words, the Holocaust wasn't just some bad apple, some really evil men behind closed doors, but rather when philosophers started to make the conclusions that there is no such thing as human dignity according to the atheistic natural world, that was the fertile soil out of which something like the Holocaust became plausible. Stephen, are you saying that if I'm an atheist, I'm going to be a Hitler? And the answer is, of course not. Most atheists I know are absolutely wonderful people. They are gentle. They love their husbands and their wives. They love their children. They care deeply about human dignity and equality and justice. My only question is, on what basis? Because there is a huge disconnect between what you claim as your worldview, however you articulate that, and how you are behaving towards your fellow human being. The naturalistic worldview simply cannot account for something that just seems so intuitive to billions of people around the world. So, if the naturalistic worldview fails to account for human dignity, I want to propose that the Christian worldview poses a solution which I think is powerful to explain this impulse, which is so observable, that somehow we take it for granted that human life has value and dignity. There is an ancient text in the Hebrew Bible that describes that humans are created in the image of God. And theologians for hundreds, if not thousands of years, have debated exactly what that means. Here is my little stab at that definition. God has uniquely invested something of himself in us that is designed to reflect the attributes and person of God to the world around us. Now, I'd say that's an ontological dignity, something that is in our essence, and it is played out functionally and relationally. But not only is this a bit of a competition to the worldviews of our current time, it was a real poke in the eye to the worldviews of its time, roughly 3,500 years ago. Because the competing worldviews to the biblical worldview of the time said that royalty are created in the image of God. Kings bear the image of the gods. And the rest of us mere mortals are simply created as slaves to the divinity. And if you think about some of these ancient cultures, you can see how very quickly they move from this thesis to living out the consequences of that worldview. But this simple idea of being made in the image of God had huge ramifications. That dignity wasn't based on being born into a royal family or wealth or earthly power. This simple idea democratized humanity, not by reducing us to the same level, but by elevating us to equal levels of status, value, and dignity. And I believe it is this idea that has formed the world that most of us live in, including the world of the secular narratives of justice and equality. In fact, it was this very idea that fueled Dr. Martin Luther King. As he fought in the civil rights movement, he said in a sermon entitled "The American Dream," he said, "There are no gradations in the image of God. Every man, from a treble white to a bass black, is significant on God's keyboard. Precisely because every man is made in the image of God. One day we will learn that. We will know one day that God made us to live together as brothers and to respect the dignity and worth of every man." Not only did this inform why he fought, it informed how he fought. Arguably with love, respect, nonviolence, because he recognized the image of God not only in the oppressed, but even in the oppressor. So if being made in the image of God, according to Genesis 1, is one of the biggest steps we can take forward to understand how the Christian worldview gives rise to human dignity, I believe that the Christian idea of grace is a second step that we can take that is so powerful to explain human dignity. I tend to drive my kids to school in the morning, and as you heard earlier, I've got two sons. And when they were about ages 5 and 7, I was trying to explain the lofty concept of unconditional love to them. So I said, boys, I don't love you because you're special. You're special because I love you. Do you understand? No, Dad, we don't understand. So I said, boys, listen, you're both very smart, intelligent, good-looking, healthy, strong. I don't love you because you're healthy. I don't love you because you're smart. I don't love you because you're strong, because you're clever. Even if you weren't clever, even if you weren't healthy, even if you weren't strong, I would still love you. Do you understand? Yes, Dad, we understand. And then one of them pops up. Dad, even though you don't have hair, we still love you. Think about how the world places value on people. When I was in my early 20s, I know it doesn't look like it now, but I used to be in a punk rock band. And I used to skateboard as well. Those two things kind of went hand in hand. I wasn't a very good skateboarder, and we had a pretty good punk rock band. But one of the whole things about being in that culture was you had to look the parts. And I used to often experience this by walking into some of the skating stores where you'd go buy all your skating merch, right? And what you would get as soon as you walked into the store is a quick up and down from the people in the store. And depending on how skater boy or punk rocked you looked, resulted in how much they respected you according to their subculture. Which is quite ironic because the punk rock world is supposed to be anti-conformity, right? We're anti the man. Anyway, think about how the world values people. It's all about how much you conform or how much you perform. It's all about what you look like, what you do, the value that you can add to my life. And when people, according to our definition of value adding, when people are doing that well, we treat them like VIPs. We give them dignity. We give them almost godlike value and dignity until they lose their money, until they lose their intellect, until they lose their moral high ground, until they lose their ability to perform. And then the world dethrones them from VIPs to VAPs, very average people. But the Christian view of grace says that your dignity has got nothing to do with how well you perform. It's got nothing to do with your intellect. It's got nothing to do with your economic ability. It's got nothing to do with your self-determination. It's got nothing to do with your wealth. It's got nothing to do with anything that is extrinsic to you. It is a gift of grace given to every human being. Jesus modeled this in his ministry. He spent most of his time around those who were esteemed less than by the religious world of his time. They were seen as those of less dignity, less worth, prostitutes, tax collectors, sinners, lepers, the outcasts. And every time Jesus encountered one of these people, there was always a net impartation of dignity, a gift of dignity, a reestablishment of their worth and their value by their Creator. But finally, we've taken a step in the Christian worldview. Step one was the idea of being created in the image of God. Step two was the Christian view of grace. And I want to conclude with the third step, that the cross is the greatest demonstration of human dignity. I mentioned earlier that I used to be in a punk rock band in my 20s, and at that time I could only afford kind of cheaper knockoff guitars. But the guitar of my dream was always a USA Fender Stratocaster. If you don't know what that is, think Eric Clapton, John Mayer, Stevie Ray Vaughan. That's the guitar that I'm talking about. And so in my 30s, I was kind of adult enough to buy my own USA Fender Stratocaster. Now, if you had to walk into a music store today and buy a USA Fender Stratocaster, it would set you back, let's call it 15 to 20,000 Rand plus. But a few years ago, a USA Fender Stratocaster was sold for $2 million. Why was that guitar valued at $2 million Whereas arguably an equally good guitar can be sold for 20,000 rand. The reason why that guitar is worth $2 million was for two reasons. Number one, that guitar was owned and played by Jimi Hendrix at Woodstock. And number two, someone was willing to pay $2 million for that guitar. You see, the Christian view of human dignity, it's not who you are that makes you dignified, it's whose you are. As we are all created in the image of God. But as I said earlier, what increased this sense of value of this guitar was that someone was willing to pay $2 million for it. If we look at the cross, we see that God in Jesus Christ was willing to pay the highest price for humanity. And so if I can end off by shamelessly reading the final paragraph from the chapter on this in my book. His life becomes the measure of the value of mankind. The cross demonstrates that Jesus not only died for those the world perceives to have value, those who have it together, those who are esteemed, popular, and successful. If anything, the cross is a brutal picture of the perfect dying for the imperfect, supreme power dying for the weak and the vulnerable, and in that one act, ascribing priceless value to every single human being on the planet. Thank you very much.